Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Kristen.
And I'm going to start off this podcast by admitting something about myself.
Oh, please do.
Which is that when I was younger and I found myself no longer believing in the Christian faith that I had grown up with, I started pursuing, as do many young people and people who feel that big religion or no religion, they still want to feel a connection to something bigger than themselves. I got into tarot cards.
Oh, tell me more, Caroline.
Yeah, so I got one of those, like, cheesy, slick, glossy, terribly illustrated packs from who knows where. Probably Hot Topic or something. I don't know. Is Hot Topic still around? I think they are, right?
Probably.
I wonder if they're still as weird as they were when I was in high school.
Yeah, tweens need to be tacky somehow.
Mall goths, yeah. So I got into it. And I found that it was a really great sort of satisfying way to feel like I was connecting with some spiritual force, that I was part of some magical, mystical, fantasy land that gave me some bit of control and insight into the world around me. And I just sort of summed up why people do tarot.
Well, I'm curious though, how often did you do it?
Maybe once a week, maybe like on the weekend or something.
And would it be used to help you figure out what to do with your life or sort of reflect on things?
I think both. A lot of it had to do with liking boys and wanting to do tarot about love. But I did the whole nine yards, Kristen. I would turn out the lights and light candles and get in the zone and breathe deeply and get real quiet internally and focus on my question, which was probably does so-and-so like me? Is so-and-so gonna like me? Which is the bulk of a lot of tarot questions in the modern era. And I'd lay out the cards in the Celtic cross formation. There's a bunch of different formations that you can do in tarot and read the cards and figure out what was negative and what was positive and if they were inverted or right side up, what that meant. And yeah, I literally can't remember any insight that it ever actually gave me or I thought that it gave me, but it was kind of a really fun way to pass the time. I was also big into runes at the time, which was the same deal. You put them in a sack and it's like Scrabble tiles and you put your hands in there and you draw out some runes and you figure out what your future is supposed to be or you figure out the answer to a question.
I'm surprised I never got into runes. That sounds right up my alley.
Well, I remember distinctly wearing my rune necklace to Music Midtown here in Atlanta in 1997, seventh grade for me. Was it 97? Yeah, I think it was 97. And I definitely like thought I was so effing cool because it was like a choker necklace. It was on, it was on like one of those black cords. It's so 90s, you know.
I have probably very hip today.
Little rune necklace. And, I can't remember what it meant. It was something like very, you know, very like middle school self-centered, like independent or like, something. I'm a cool person rune.
I don't even care about my curfew rune.
Right.
After college, my roommates and I went through a tarot phase, but it was more a thing of a parlor game.
Yeah.
When we would all hang out, people would come over, have some beers, and be like, let's do tarot. Oh my God, what's it mean? Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Since we're drunk.
Yeah, yes. That is what it meant for people hundreds and hundreds of years ago, too. You and your friends were far more connected to the true roots of tarot than seventh grade Caroline was, I assure you.
Yeah, because here's the thing about the history of tarot. It's a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah.
Because it really just started out as a game. And we've been making up the rules for tarot ever since.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, and so it's so, I don't know what word to use here, but I put my hands to my face and look real worried when I read like first person accounts of tarot card readers and like how seriously so many people take it. It's like a huge part of some people's lives. And I don't want to dismiss that part of your life, fair listeners, but there's literally no mystical meaning behind tarot. Like Kristen said, its meaning has changed over the centuries. It really did originate in the Islamic and Arabic world as just cards. The fabulous people in the Middle East invented playing cards, and they were beautiful. They were hand painted. They were something that the wealthy had to pass the time. And so they were painted with all sorts of things that would be familiar to these people in their everyday lives. So there'd be architectural elements painted on there. Later there would be people or items represented on the cards, but they were all meant to just play games. And so, these cards, of course, through trade, through military invasions, made their way to Europe. They've been used, everything from games, like we said, to literary prompts for writers, to the way we think of them now as tools for divination.
Although I do like, and not to get ahead of ourselves, but I do like how long we have been using tarot, even pre-divination phase, to help us predict whether someone will like us back or not.
Yes, there was one Spanish deck that was meant to figure out the object of your affection. And each suit, so like the cups or the wands or whatever, each suit of the deck corresponded to a different type of woman, either maidens, wives, widows, or nuns.
Always get the nuns.
Always a nun, never a maiden.
But tarot, as we think of it today, really got its start in Italy, I believe, around the 15th century. But again, it was nothing but a game at that time. And from Italy, it was exported to France and Germany. And tarot had no history as a game in English-speaking areas. It was introduced instead by occultists.
So that's interesting, right? That little tidbit about how people in Italy, France, and Germany were thinking of it as a game. Even if it did have a divination bent, it was still sort of a playful thing. Versus in England, where they didn't get it until some kind of shady occultist, as we'll get into in greater detail much later in the podcast, they introduced it as an actual mystical, magical thing. So to give a brief rundown of tarot decks today, they've got 78 cards. 56 are the minor arcana or the suit cards. So like the, you know, seven of wands, and 22 make up the major arcana or trump cards. You've got four suits, swords, batons, cups, and coins, each of which has an ace through a 10 in addition to the jack through king. The major cards also have a fool, which is traditionally labeled as zero.
And today, of course, people read all sorts of meanings into tarot cards. So for me, growing up in a very conservative home, tarot cards were seen as a tool of the devil.
As they can be.
But then, of course, there are people who use tarot to predict the future. Some see it as a gateway to mystical beings or otherworldly knowledge. And then others use it more as a meditative device, just to reflect and get more insight on yourself and also relationships. And tarot was something that came up in your conversation, Caroline, a few months back in 2015 with author Jessa Crispin, who wrote The Dead Ladies Project.
Yeah, she wrote The Dead Ladies Project. She also founded the website Book Slut, and she's got a pretty cool tarot side business. She herself got into it as sort of a backup job while she was between gigs, and now reads tarot for people, not as a way to like predict the future, but as almost sort of a literary inspirational device to help you sort of figure out your narrative or figure out what your own strengths are. But let's dive in now and take a closer look at tarot's origins and evolution. And a lot of this is coming from a great article over at Collectors Weekly, which has some beautiful images of all of those cards from the Islamic world.
So we mentioned the 15th century, and it was between the 14th and 15th centuries that people started using cards for games and playful divination, emphasis on playful. And it was something called Mamluk game cards that were brought to Western Europe from the Middle East. And in the Islamic world, as Caroline mentioned, card playing was really something for the highborn. And these cards were just miniature pieces of art. They were often hand painted, and they would be scrawled with calligraphy. Whereas in Europe, they lost a little bit of their class because you have printing technology, which did mean, though, that it became something that wasn't only exclusive to the wealthiest. More people could get their hands literally on these cards and paper products, but they probably weren't hand painted. But if you look at the Arabic calligraphy, they would often contain aphorisms or sort of mini fortunes, such as, "As for the present that rejoices, thy heart will soon open up." Oh, fingers crossed. Or how about this? This takes a little darker turn. "With the sword of happiness, I shall redeem a beloved who will afterwards take my life." Whoa, buyer beware.
Oh, boy. Oh, it doesn't sound like a good relationship.
That sword of happiness will get you every time.
Yeah. So by the 1500s in Europe, you've got these beautiful cards being used for literary exercises. So not too different from what Jessa Crispin is using it for herself. And games that are similar to modern day bridge. And you get some more playful divination. So Italian aristocrats were playing this game, Tarocchi Appropriati. Basically, you'd be dealt random cards and have to write poetic verses about other players based on the content and the imagery of those cards. And I love that Collectors Weekly compares it to an early version of MASH. Like, I'm gonna live in the mansion with the Humvee and have Bobby as my husband.
Oh, Bobby. I wanted Bobby.
But this really evolved into a literary phenomenon. I mean, people were writing lots of stories and poetry based on the cards that they were drawing.
It also reminds me of, what's it called, Exquisite Corpse, where you start a story and then you fold a piece of paper until only the last sentence is revealed, and you pass it around, the person picks up the story, and then it flows from there. But it's not a card game, although it should be. But back to tarot, pre-tarot decks start to develop as you have wealthy Italian families commissioning their own hand-painted cards of triumph.
Yeah.
How boss is that? To be like, I am so rich, I'm going to have some cards of triumph made just for myself. And they had the same suits as those Arabic Mamluk cards of cups, swords, coins, and polo sticks, which would eventually become your wands or batons.
Yeah, and of course they had the courts of kings and male underlings. We didn't have queens yet, go figure. And in the 17th century, we see the Tarot de Marseille originate. And this is one of the most common types of tarot decks
ever produced. It was usually printed with wood blocks and colored in by hand with basic stencils. And it's worth noting that this is not one specific deck, but rather a style that's seen in France that would be copied a whole lot. So of course, you know, once it's out of the hands, or it's trickled down, I guess I should say, from the rich Italians all the way to France and Germany, that's when you start seeing decks like the Tarot de Marseille.
But there was some controversy, right?
There was a bit of controversy.
So there was a Papus card, and Papus, if that does sound to you like papal, you're right. A lady pope, though, heck no. So, but of course, since we could not have a lady pope, she morphed into, depending on your deck, either Juno, the high priestess, or the Spanish captain. But in the case of the high priestess, the high priest counterpart would be the Pope.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm back.
Well, I mean, so throughout these cards' history, your imagery just depended on your worldview. I mean, there were tarot. So from the very beginning, tarot imagery was morphing to accommodate common beliefs at the time. But I love that in the Tarot de Marseille, there are some pretty cool lady imagery. Strength is a woman subduing a lion. The Empress is a pretty badass shield. You've got the Star, who's a naked lady pouring water. And I'm sure that there are tarot aficionados out there going like, oh, it's not what it is, or it's not what it means, but I still love it. And then the woman on the World card in this particular tarot deck, honestly, to me, looks like she's standing inside a vagina. The description says otherwise.
But almost as if she's birthing herself.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, that's what I'm going with. And no one can tell me otherwise.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by Pedigree. True love is always being excited from the first moment you see one another and every time after that. It's taking long walks together in the summer, gazing longingly into each other's eyes and, well, watching their tail wag when they chase a squirrel in the yard.
The Pedigree brand asked about believing in love at first sight. And honestly, the answer is yes. And I know you listeners know my love, Peaches Gertrude McPherson, whom I've talked about so much. And she really was love at first sight. But I will tell you that it took a long time for me to find her. I actually was looking for a good 2 years before I stumbled upon her picture from my local shelter and knew the moment I saw her that she was the one. And the minute I tell you when I saw that picture and I went to meet her out the shelter and I sat with her for a good 20 minutes, y'all, I couldn't leave her. I knew she had to be mine. I knew we belonged together.
Peaches and I are friends as well. We have a good relationship together. So you can find love at first sight with the Pedigree Adoption Drive June 7th to 9th, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more about the adoption drive and to see full terms and conditions.
So then in the 18th century, we have the rise of mystical tarot, but for surprising reasons.
Yeah. So, this goes back to a lot of the ideas we talked about, Kristen, fair listeners, in our episode on witchcraft. Because in that episode, we talked a lot about how it was men, elite male members of society, who were members of secret Masonic societies and groups, who got together and sort of, in order to give their own organizations and themselves authenticity and credibility, they tried to link their made-up organizational mythology with existing mythology about Egyptians and Greeks and Romans, and that gave rise to a lot of our modern day ideas about witchcraft. And the same is true for tarot. So you've got to get a little context. In the 18th century, power structures across Europe were shifting from feudalism to capitalism. And you've got these mysterious, well, on purpose mysterious, they made themselves mysterious, and male hierarchy driven Freemasonry. These groups and their interest in the occult is on the rise. And as Mike Sosterik in A Sociology of Tarot points out, those secret society hierarchies reproduced and reaffirmed the patriarchy, unequal power relations, and male hegemony. In other words, they were filling this power vacuum as positions of power shifted from being inherited. So rich people beget more rich people who are all in the powerful positions. Not that that doesn't exist, but you know what I mean. To being earned, powerful positions being earned through that Protestant work ethic and knowing the right people. And these secret societies were all about knowing the right people.
Well, and it's ironic that you just mentioned the Protestant work ethic, because part of the pathway to knowing the right people and getting an in with these societies and getting a leg up, therefore, you know, in your station in life, had to do with getting a grasp of this occult tarot that they kind of made up. They developed as part of their mythology this connection between tarot cards and Egypt, because intellectuals commonly believed ancient Egyptian writing and religion held insights into human existence. And so they took their tarot cards and linked that to ancient Egypt as a way of gaining credibility and authority, rather than being like, here's this game we play and we kind of made up what it means. Who wants to join us? It's so fun.
Yeah, it was just another way of being like, hey, we are the holders of the mystical, magical truth. You've got to go through us to get to the truth. And also what was so appealing about these cards for these rich white guys was that they were links to a way of life that was enjoyed by those rich, wealthy, high-born Italian families of the 15th century. I mean, the imagery itself is related to royalty and the elite. You've got those kings and queens and popes. And then the great thing about tarot, and great may or may not be in quotes, is that the imagery is so easy to manipulate. The meaning behind the imagery is so easy to manipulate and so easy to tell other people that it means something. And, you know, like we talked about in our psychics episode, Kristen, it's just human nature to want to believe in this stuff. And I get it, but it's worth discussing how a lot of this magical belief system came out of a bunch of guys who were just trying to use these cards and imbue them with their own meaning in order to cement their fancy status.
Well, and to the point that they even created tarot decks with Egyptian imagery to only reinforce this made up connection between the two. And you have, though, two big names who are responsible for really cementing this mystical development of tarot, both of whom are French. You first have Antoine Court de Jablin, who was a French writer, pastor, and Freemason, a real jack of all trades.
Seriously.
There. And then you have even more famous teacher and publisher, Jean-Baptiste Alliette, who went by a pseudonym, which was just his last name, Alliette, backwards.
Yeah, so it's Atella. Atelia?
Nutella. It's Nutella.
Yeah, he went by Nutella.
He invented Nutella.
Nutella and Jebelin were the first to align the tarot with these mystical and divinatory properties. So In 1781, in his 9-volume History of the World, which is quite impressive, he didn't have Wikipedia or anything, de Gebelin said that tarot was based on a holy book written by Egyptian priests and brought to Europe by gypsies from Africa. So I'm like, I'm so impressed that in your History of the World, you managed to make so much of it up. Alliette, meanwhile, wrote his own book on the tarot and claimed that he learned divination with playing cards first, but added his special Atelier card, the Nutella card, which, as in modern tarot, was meant to basically stand in for the person having his or her fortune read. Eventually, he switches over to using a quote-unquote true tarot deck and publishes his own, which is one of the very first designed specifically for divination, not just for game playing, claiming, again, people, that it had secret wisdom passed down from ancient Egypt. I mean, people, stop making stuff up.
Well, or just stop being so gullible.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that too. But so, of course, because this is something of the elite, it makes sense that it would eventually trickle down and be considered real cool. Real cool. It's like, I don't know what's, hoverboards are real cool. Maybe they're trickling down. What's trickling down now? I don't know.
Definitely hoverboards.
Definitely. But so tarot trickles down to the rank and file. And so by 1790, we get our first celebrity card reader.
What? And she is a lady, hence the pronoun.
She is a lady. It's Mademoiselle Lenormand, or Marie Anne Adelaide Lenormand, who shows up in Paris claiming that she learned card reading again from gypsies. And here's the context, because I know people are not a fan of the term gypsy. It's not a great term to use. There was this idea at the time that gypsies were people who were roaming around Europe from Egypt, hence the name. And so there again is our Egyptian connection, to give herself legitimacy. She even read cards for Empress Josephine using Alliette's deck that he designed.
Yeah, there's that famous painting. I think it might be called The Fortune Teller, which is essentially depicting Lenormand reading in front of Josephine, and you have Napoleon to the side. And there's also a depiction of her actually reading Napoleon's cards, but as a tarot expert Mary Greer notes, it is highly unlikely that she actually did that for Napoleon, but she definitely read for Josephine. And as Greer also notes, it is thanks to this woman that the world really found out about tarot, that it became this big thing. And after she died, oracle decks were published with her name on them.
Sort of like a celebrity endorsement. I mean, she was dead, but trading on her name.
It's like celebrity perfumes today.
Yeah. But dead lady tarot cards.
Yeah, totally the same thing.
Totally. I'm sure they smelled like something.
I tell you what, though, when she was alive, descriptions of her were none too kind.
No.
In 1815, a visitor described her as a monstrous toad, bloated and venomous. She had one walleye, but the other was a piercer. Which I really enjoyed. She wore a fur cap upon her head, from beneath which she glared out upon her horrified visitors.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So, you know, we've got the origins of tarot, mystic tarot and tarot card reading among these elite men, right? And as it trickles down, we start to see fortune tellers and card readers being depicted, like we talked about in our last episode, as women and as, in this case, toad-like monstrous women. But I have to give you a little historical side note tidbit. In 1791, there's this book on fortune telling, right? And it's expanded to include chapters on card tossing and also coffee ground reading. And its title, and this does tie into the whole gender thing, was Every Lady's Own Fortune Teller, or an infallible guide to the hidden decrees of fate, being a new and regular system for fortune telling future events, to which is added a new method of fortune telling by the dregs of coffee. So, ladies, you need to pick yourself up a book.
Yeah, I mean, and that was something that Mary Greer noted in her very comprehensive History of Tarot. Once you get to the 19th century, it really was a lady's pastime. It was something associated with old women, soldiers' wives, and ladies playing these parlor games. And there's all sorts of artwork depicting this, of women huddled together reading their own cards. There is an excerpt from Casanova's diaries of talking about this horribly underaged girl. I think she was like 13, where he was like, I mean, I was into it, but she was always obsessed with reading her tarot cards, you know, to find out if I was gallivanting or not.
Well, I thought the description was actually hysterical because he's like, she's so jealous. All she does is put the cards down and point out to me all the ways in which I was like in bed with someone at this place at this time. And I just pictured like this jealous girlfriend. It does ruin the hilarity of the story that she was so young, but,
but by this time, I mean, it's pretty well established that tarot is a female pastime in a lot of ways that men would kind of snicker at because it was a lady's pastime.
Yeah, that it was scorned by men. And she does point out at her really, really fantastic and fascinating blog that you get this underground at the time of mostly older women who made a good, if precarious, she says, living out of various forms of divination. So we start to see women who perhaps don't have any other way to make money outside of the house. And here they are able, in basically sort of an intimate, not too public setting, making money off of the sort of emotional and psychological desires of other people.
Which completely relates to our previous episode on women and psychics. But we need to move forward in our little timeline to the turn of the century. But first, you guessed it, we got to take a quick break.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by Pedigree. True love is always being excited from the first moment you see one another and every time after that. It's taking long walks together in the summer, gazing longingly into each other's eyes and, well, watching their tail wag when they chase a squirrel in the yard.
The Pedigree brand asked about believing in love at first sight. And honestly, the answer is yes. And I know you listeners know my love, Peaches Gertrude McPherson, whom I've talked about so much. And she really was love at first sight. But I will tell you that it took a long time for me to find her. I actually was looking for a good 2 years before I stumbled upon her picture from my local shelter and knew the moment I saw her that she was the one. And the minute I tell you when I saw that picture and I went to meet her out the shelter and I sat with her for a good 20 minutes, y'all, I couldn't leave her. I knew she had to be mine. I knew we belonged together.
Peaches and I are friends as well. We have a good relationship together. So you can find love at first sight with the Pedigree Adoption Drive June 7th to 9th, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more about the adoption drive and to see full terms and conditions.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
So as we move into the 19th and 20th centuries, those secret and occult societies that we talked about earlier are still pretty much dominated by dudes. But you do have groups emerging like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and the Theosophical Society, which were co-ed. And I think it's interesting that the Theosophical Society, for instance, even had women among its founders and leaders. But people in these groups were super fixated on uncovering the quote-unquote true tarot and the card's true meanings, which is like, guys, like 100 years ago, you invented this. Don't know if you realize that it was just a card game in the Arabic world and in Italy, and then you guys were the ones who made it magical.
But they didn't have podcasts back then, Carolyn. How would they know?
How would they know? But they were so intent on buying into this whole thing of like, tarot has a true meaning, and we're gonna find it, and we're the holders of this truth, so we're gonna be a part of delivering the true tarot to the people.
Oh, but what, I mean, that just opens up a whole occultist playground for you to kinda get to, you know, do what you want and make up whatever connections you want to.
Just like a man.
Or woman. These were co-ed.
They
groups,
were co-ed.
Some of them.
There was one very fascinating woman who's been, well, not anymore so much, but at the time was left out of tarot history.
Yeah, this is the thing. If you own a deck of tarot cards, there is a very good chance that you have seen the artwork of Pamela Pixie Coleman Smith, because the most famous deck in tarot history is the Rider-Waite deck, which was printed in 1909 and named for publisher William Rider and popular mystic A.E. Waite. And you might be like, wait, why isn't it the, oh, wait, huh? Why isn't it the Rider-Waite Coleman Smith deck, huh?
Well, because she was a lady person.
And an artist.
And Waite was a jerk and pretty much purposely left her name out. But so the Rider-Waite deck is so famous. It's the first mass market tarot deck, which also helped boost tarot's popularity. And again, its intention was divination, not playing those Italian mind games. And it even came with a book explaining the meaning behind Coleman Smith's imagery.
And imagine what a huge job this is, because Coleman Smith has to illustrate 78 cards in about 6 months. And her illustrations are notable because her pip cards told stories. And the pip cards are those lesser cards, not the ones that are, you know, the fancy, like, this is the sun, this is the hermit, etc. So all the cards together tell a story.
Which, again, is a great way if you're trying to get people to connect with imagery or connect with a philosophy. This is a great way to do it because your pictures tell 1,000 words. And so to place all of these amazing illustrations on each card and then to do a tarot formation, it's so easy to tell a story and be able to interpret those images kind of however you or the card reader wants.
Well, since I was raised in a household where tarot cards were tools of the devil.
Yeah.
After college, when my roommates got some tarot cards, it was the first time I'd ever seen tarot cards up close and held them. And I was enamored with the illustrations. And I love thinking about how, oh, I was so blown away by this unsung lady artist's work because, I mean, they really are gorgeous.
Yeah, and she has a fascinating story. So she's born in 1878 in London to American parents, and they lived all over, including in Jamaica. And she's such a cutie, if you see pictures of her. But people at the time very, like, euphemistically and quietly questioned her true parenting, basically. They were like, you know, she's awfully dark and queer looking. Perhaps her actual parents are Jamaican. And her parents themselves were very artistic. And under their influence, she ends up joining a touring theater group as an actor, costume maker, and set designer. She's super artistic. She ends up studying art at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. She became an illustrator for Yeats, Bram Stoker, and others. And a lot of her personal art, interestingly enough, was a reflection of her synesthesia. So she would listen to these symphonies and then paint. So it results in this swooping, sweeping imagery that's so beautiful. And also another tidbit of how like really cool this lady is. As a member of the group Suffrage Atelier, she puts her art to use for suffrage posters and cartoons.
And her talent didn't stop there. She was also a writer, publishing several plays and books, including a collection of Jamaican folklore, which she would just go out and recite at events, which kind of blows my mind because, hello, stage fright. but I love this excerpt from Brooklyn Life magazine from 1907, which some hipster should really revive ASAP. They described her as a gentlewoman presenting an odd type of thoroughly unconventional femininity. And therein lies her greatest charm, which I think is an old school way of saying she's not like other girls.
Yeah. She's like the cool girl, but we're kind of suspicious of her because she wears all those billowy garments. She even started her own magazine called The Green Sheaf, which certainly did have other contributors, but it was mainly a way for her to publish her writing.
Oh, like a zine.
Yeah.
She's like a little riot girl.
Yes, she is. So her introduction to tarot and creating the cards comes in 1901 when she joined the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which is where she met A.E. Waite, as well as Yeats and Aleister Crowley, that scoundrel who you'll remember from our witchcraft episode, helped this guy Gerald Gardner write a quote-unquote manual for witchcraft rituals. And Crowley was also the future creator of the equally famous Thoth Tarot.
Yeah, the Thoth tarot cards are intense.
So Coleman Smith's cards are printed with pretty, not that great fanfare, and nobody's really into it because at this point in England, people are still like, what is this French thing? I'm not into this. But it's so great when you read stuff about Coleman Smith because she was very clear about having her own ideas about how you should prepare to read the cards. The whole thing that seventh grade Caroline went through of like, quiet the mind, think about your question, picture your question, and then flip the cards over. And in terms of her illustrations, the deck itself is clearly inspired by this 15th century Italian deck called the Sola Busca. But they, in turn, her illustrations in turn, inspired their own future imitators.
And I love this fact. So she used her own cat for one of the illustrations.
Who I think was named Snuffles.
Snuffles, of course it was. So Snuffles inspired future artists and card readers to interpret it as a million different symbols and meanings, which ultimately it's just Snuffles.
Yeah, it's just her cat. Aww. She also used her buddy slash potentially lover or companion, Edie Craig, as a model for some of the women on the cards. And so isn't that fascinating to know that here's this person who was like under the gun to create all these beautiful illustrations in 6 months for very little pay, using her own characters from her own life to create these mystical tarot figures. And people today are still interpreting them and reinterpreting them as these magical, mystical beings. I just love it.
But even though her work was so significant and she put so much thought into it, and people have in turn put so much thought into her cards, she was completely left out. She received no mention by name in the book that accompanied the deck, and Waite referred to her only as a, quote, young woman artist who'd illustrated the cards based on his instructions. She received very little payment and no royalties. And in one letter to her agent, she even said, I just did a huge project for very little pay, just basically saying, like, I know. I'm just hustling here.
And in case you were wondering about the true nature of Waite's character, he indeed was a jerk. He wrote, "The practice of painting among women has been clumsily cultivated. It remains a bad imitation of nature, whereas it might be a great art." I'm like, dude, if you are so like anti-woman and anti-woman artist, why did you even hire this woman? Oh, could it be because she's actually really talented and you just don't want to give her any credit?
And maybe easier to discredit her.
Yeah. Mm.
But for Coleman Smith's part, she converted to Catholicism and ran a priest's retreat in Cornwall, but then died penniless in 1951, even though if she'd gotten royalties on that deck, she would have been sitting pretty.
Yeah, total millionaire.
Yeah.
The deck ends up falling out of use until about the 70s when you've got American playing card manufacturer U.S. Games, I believe it is, who reprinted them. And it was the U.S. Games guy who was saying that Coleman Smith could have been a millionaire today.
Well, she's not the only tarot illustrator of note. In the late 1930s, Marguerite Frieda Harris, aka Lady Frieda Harris, met Aleister Crowley at 60 years old and painted the images for his Thoth tarot deck over and over again across 5 years. I mean, think about that. Coleman Smith did hers in 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Frieda Harris is a pretty interesting character. She herself was very wealthy, as indicated by the title Lady. Like, she was doing all right. She didn't need a bunch of money. She also didn't need a bunch of notoriety.
Oh, it just wasn't a nickname. She was like, call me Lady.
Well, I mean, you've got people like Mademoiselle Lenormand, you know, like people who, not that Mademoiselle is not just a normal French courtesy title. But you've got people who are really playing up their, like, mystical associations, but she really was a lady. But yeah, she and Aleister Crowley had this fascinating correspondence, and they were total buds and BFFs. In one letter, she told him to basically shut up. She's tired of being his bank. And listen, Crowley, your notes for these illustrations are terrible. You're so stupid. But if you go through their letters and read them, they're very close. They're both in this mystical secret society, and they talk so much about issues of these secret societies and knowledge and truth and religion and all of this great stuff. And they were very, very close. But yeah, like Kristen said, it's crazy to think that she was doing these paintings over 5 whole years, where Coleman Smith had to smush it into 6 months.
And listeners, you have to Google image the Thoth deck if you haven't seen it already, because the art is wild. Harris used projected synthetic geometry to create these almost like Salvador Dali-esque paintings or illustrations, I should say. And they really do look like something out of a sci-fi book.
Yeah, they really do look like, because I was looking at the cards and I was like, why do these look familiar to me? And because they look exactly like contemporary sci-fi illustrations, like that early sci-fi stuff you see on book covers.
I think, though, if I ever tried to use the Thoth deck, I would just get really confused and tired because the illustrations are so abstract.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and whereas Coleman Smith's illustrations were sort of grounded in that 15th century Italian deck, Frieda Harris's illustrations were just, I mean, they were definitely a joint project between her and Crowley. Like, he gave her plenty of feedback. It almost reads like a graphic designer client email thread going back and forth, but her illustrations were off the chart. I mean, they were something totally different. So obviously tarot today still plays a huge role in divination, in connections with the occult, but also just in people's day-to-day lives, seeking meaning or maybe seeking some insight into the world around them. But sociologist Mike Sesterik, who we mentioned earlier, has nothing nice to say. He's not into that at all. He's really concerned about how easily people today have taken up tarot ideology that has roots in those Masonic societies, which he said are so problematic because those groups are based in classist, racist, and sexist traditions. He says that those groups not only barred people's participation, women, people of color, people of lower classes, but they also borrow heavily and appropriate from histories and traditions that aren't theirs.
So are tarot cards an example of cultural appropriation?
According to the sociologist, yeah.
Wow. Well, and he also admits that not only tarot, but religion in general persists to fulfill that basic human need of explaining the world around you and kind of relieving our anxieties. So, I mean, there is a method to our madness.
Yeah, and it's why things like the goddess movement that we talked about in our witchcraft episode can be so powerful. They fill a vacuum, that need for spiritual fulfillment. And they reframe the normal patriarchal structure to one focusing on women. I mean, similarly, you have tarot decks from the 80s, I believe, like Thea's Tarot, which was created by Ruth West. And that's exclusively feminine focused and non-traditional, with exclusively women on the card, some of which are renamed. And then you've got the more recent She Is Sitting in the Night tarot book, which is a more recent feminist lesbian tarot book. So you've got stuff that's grounded in patriarchal Masonic traditions, but being reclaimed, I don't know if I can say reclaimed, but being claimed by
women in the 21st century who are pointing it in a totally different direction.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's safe to say that a lot of millennial feminists are totally into tarot. There was even, we even have a trend piece to back up our observations. There was a whole thing in Newsweek about it, and they relate it to how organized religion has declined. Our participation has declined among the millennial generation, especially according to a 2012 Pew study. And the millennials that Newsweek interviewed said that astrology and tarot are their favorite supernatural tools for combating essentially existential angst.
I mean, that's what I was doing in seventh grade, I guess. There's some theories. Susan Miller, who's an astrologer, tells Newsweek that astrology, for instance, has a very firm structure. And a couple of the people that Newsweek talked to, young women specifically, were like, yeah, you know what? It helps me clarify feelings, my feelings about my uncertain future. It helps me reduce a little bit of that recession anxiety. Not to mention, they talked to one woman who not only used it to alleviate her recession anxiety, but because she was out of a job, she used tarot to make money, similar to Jessa Crispin. So lots of stuff wrapped up in that capitalistic tradition that's passed down from the Freemasons.
Yeah, and yet the thing that I haven't seen an uptick in is elite dudes, or just dudes in general, picking up the tarot deck casually.
No, I think it's another thing that's been feminized in people's minds, that that's some silly magic stuff that old crones do.
Well, I'm very curious now to hear from listeners with knowledge of the tarot or any kind of interaction. If we have any tarot readers listening, we want to hear from you. MomStuff@HowStuffWorks.com is our email address. You can also tweet us at MomStuffPodcast or message us on Facebook. And we've got a couple of messages to share with you right now.
I have a letter here from Isabella. She starts it off by saying, in the voice of the worm from Labyrinth, hello, ladies. Hello, Isabella. She says, I haven't even finished your podcast on adult acne, but I had to get in touch to encourage other listeners to get their hormones checked if they suddenly develop acne in their 20s and 30s. As a clear-skinned teen growing up, I was immensely relieved that I didn't have to deal with chronic acne like some of my friends. Don't get me wrong, I got the odd spot, but it was never anything worth complaining about, and so I traversed my teenage years worrying about periods, boys, extra hair, and all those other lovely symptoms of puberty, bar acne, for which I was very grateful. Fast forward a few years to the age of 22, working in London, alone, in a stressful job with a terrible boss, and suddenly spots everywhere. At first, I put this down to stress and some kind of karmic comeuppance, but as the months passed and endless topical treatments failed, I went into a really, really dark place, something I can only see with hindsight. After quitting my job in a blaze of glory, I took my mom's advice and went to an endocrinologist who diagnosed me with polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is fairly common, 1 in 10, and results in a higher androgen level in the blood than normal, which, as you said in your podcast, causes the devil dots. I was put on Yasmin straight away, and 6 months later, my skin had cleared up. I'm 27 now. Side note, I switched from Yasmin to another birth control brand due to questions regarding Yasmin's safety, and I'm still grateful when I look in the mirror and don't see spots. As you always say, hormones control everything in your body, and no amount of face washing and topical ointments will change what is going on inside of you. Even if for peace of mind, get your hormones checked out if you develop severe adult acne. If it is PCOS, it's amazingly easy to treat and has made a huge difference to my self-image. You both do a great job, and my boyfriend and I look forward to listening to more of your podcasts while I deal with some of his occasional spots. Yep, Kristen, other couples do that as well. So thank you, Isabella.
Well, I've got a letter here from R about our anal sex episode. She writes, I was so delighted to listen to your podcast on the topic of anal sex. I've had a variety of first-hand experiences, both positive and negative. As a teenager, I had an underwhelming first experience with a high school boyfriend, and shortly afterward experienced an older lover pressuring me to try again. It was when I was in my early 20s and in a long-term relationship with someone that I was comfortable enough to be with, to sexually explore, that I became one of those who not only has anal often, but absolutely loves it. Well, of course it isn't for everyone. I've found it so enjoyable and intimate, and I've certainly found it improving my ability to orgasm. I was recently talking about this with my best friend, and we've discussed how we each feel confident and like we have full agency over our sexuality when we perform this act. It was so great to be able to listen to a whole podcast about this activity that we both love, and it would be a wonderful thing if everyone who wants to try could do so in a comfortable and enjoyable way. As you said, the statistics on just how many teenagers have such negative experiences is a strong testament to how vital comprehensive sex education is. This is something I have found over and over again in the UK. When I was pressured to comply as a teenager, I had never been told that I had agency to say no, and I remember overhearing girls at school discussing stories much like the ones related in the podcast. I'm about to start working with therapists within my old high school to improve the sex education, and I've definitely got a huge amount of information from Sminty. Thank you guys so much for all the amazing work you do. Listening to you always makes me smile. So thanks so much, R. And thanks to everybody who's written in to us. momstuff@howstuffworks.com is our email address. And for links to all of our social media, as well as all of our blogs, videos, and podcasts, with links to our sources so you can learn more about tarot cards, head on over to stuffmomnevertoldyou.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This episode is brought to you by Pedigree.
If you've been looking for love at first sight, it is closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide.
Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more about the adoption drive and to see full terms and conditions.